If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, welcome to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. My name is Henry Melcher. I'm a producer at the show. So the show is on hiatus this week, but the podcast is not on hiatus. The podcast never takes hiatus, so we have a whole new episode for you. First, Seth checks in on cybersecurity, how vulnerable our systems are, and why that really matters. After that, he talks to reporter McKay Coppins about his history covering Donald Trump and how he and McKay both told Donald Trump, essentially to his face, that he would never run for president and how wrong they were. After that, just for this podcast, I continue chatting with McKay about his career as a reporter. By the way, if you are enjoying this podcast, please tell your friends to listen to the podcast. They can get it for free on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts. So thanks so much for that. And let's get started with Seth checking in on cybersecurity.
The midterm elections are just months away. So how concerned should we be about a foreign power once again meddling in our elections? For a look into how vulnerable our infrastructure is to getting hacked, it's time for the check-in. Even before Trump became president, he demonstrated that he didn't really take the issue of hacking too seriously. How do I know? Well, because he publicly appealed to a foreign adversary to continue hacking into the emails of his opponent at the time, Hillary Clinton.
I will tell you this. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
That's right. Trump didn't just not take it seriously. He encouraged it. He's like one of those parents who say, if you kids are going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house. And then when you're good and buzzed, I have shrooms in the freezer. Now, one of the reasons Russia was able to hack into the DNC and meddle in our presidential election is that we were ill-prepared for such an attack. And to be fair, no one was ready. There was little preparation and bumbling responses from both sides of the aisle. But now Trump is in charge, and that's disconcerting considering this is how he talks about cybersecurity and technology in general.
Now the cyber is so big. Maybe there's something with the crazy computers. You know, in the old days, everything was better, right? Now you have to open up things, press a computer, takes you 15 minutes. You know, we're in a cyber world. This is now a cyber world. Russia is knocking us off. We talk about the hacking, and hacking's bad, and it shouldn't be done. A hacker, some guy with a 200 IQ that can't get up in the morning, okay?
Sounds like he's got a handle on it. It reminds me of old Law & Order episodes where someone tries to explain the internet to Lenny Briscoe. So you're telling me I can type something here and somebody else can read it in another city? What a world. Okay, so it's clear that Trump is no expert on this topic, but at least when he became president, he had his choice of anyone he wanted to put in charge of cybersecurity, and he went with the young, charismatic tech whiz, Rudy Giuliani. Even though he couldn't recognize Rudy when he was sitting right in front of him.
I want to introduce Rudy Giuliani, and Rudy's very much of an expert on cybersecurity. It's been a very important thing to him and to what he does, and maybe I'll ask Rudy to say a few words.
Well, thanks, Rudy. Thank you very, very much, Mr. President. First of all, congratulations on what is, in fact, a historic start of an administration.
He was directly across the table from him. How is Trump going to find the hackers when he can't even find Rudy Giuliani at the same table? No one else looks like Rudy Giuliani. Was there another 200-year-old, bald, beady-eyed man at the table? Now, over a year after that proclamation, reports say Giuliani's committee accomplished pretty much nothing. But luckily, Trump didn't just leave Rudy in charge of it all. He also tasked Jared Kushner with helping to lead cybersecurity efforts in addition to being in charge of creating peace in the Middle East, fixing the VA, and solving the opioid crisis while simultaneously going through puberty.
Many of our federal systems are decades old. We are here to improve the day-to-day lives of the average citizen. That's a core promise, and we are keeping it.
That's right. Jared Kushner, the guy whose previous relationship to the internet was, I'm guessing, clearing the search history before his mom got home. Jared, what are you doing? Oh, just the Middle East, fixing the Middle East. Just Middle East stuff. Now, back in October, we thought we'd finally learn more about what exactly the administration plans to do to prevent other countries from hacking into our databases. But unfortunately, Trump's cybersecurity czar, Rob Joyce, didn't show up to a hearing on U.S. cyber defense strategy. The White House actually blocked him from testifying, citing executive privilege, resulting in an empty chair with his name tag during the hearing. And that only seemed to encourage senators on the committee to draw attention to his absence.
The empty chair is outrageous. We had a foreign government go at the heart of our democracy.
We see the person in charge at an empty seat here today.
But let's be honest, even when Trump administration officials do show up for questioning, senators are also pretty much just talking to empty chairs. Just take a look at this.
I can't answer with definitive what the conclusion is.
Yeah, I don't know what the barriers are. Senator, I don't understand it.
Wish I could give you that number. I don't know.
I don't know.
I have no idea. Do I know what now?
What now? Now, this particular empty chair, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced just last month that the Department of Justice would create a new cybersecurity task force in order to study election interference. The DOJ is tasked with providing a report on its findings at the end of June. But beyond that, we don't know much more about this task force. But what we already know about the situation in general is that it may be a little too late for more studies and reports.
Frankly, the United States is under attack.
Russian meddling is a very real threat in the upcoming election, and the U.S. is unprepared.
Until we have some deterrent capacity, we are going to continue to be attacked.
If we don't change the dynamic here, this is going to continue, and 2016 won't be viewed as something isolated. This is something will be sustained over time.
Now, if that's not enough to scare you, that guy right there, NSA Chief Mike Rogers, who's actually retiring this spring, also indicated that he hasn't received orders from Trump to disrupt Russian cyber attacks targeting elections. And after months and months of inaction, the State Department was finally given $120 million to fight Russian election meddling. And of that $120 million, it has spent $0. Now, to be fair, the Trump administration is probably saving all that money for goodbye cakes for all the people leaving the White House. That's not official. It's just we're taping at 6:30, so it's a guess. Meanwhile, the Senate is still waiting. Still waiting to get detailed cybersecurity plans from this administration. Because right now, Trump's cyber plan seems to boil down to...
Do I know what now?
This has been The Check-In. Our guest is an author and staff writer for The Atlantic. Please welcome to the show, McKay Coppins, everyone. You?
I'm good.
I'm so happy we're finally meeting in person. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. The piece that I think first put you on my radar was in 2014. You were covering a Donald Trump speech in New Hampshire. This is when he was sort of pretending to be a politician or somebody who might run for office.
Yes.
You then, because of a storm, you ended up flying back with him to Mar-a-Lago.
Yes.
And you wrote an article about those 36 hours.
I spent 36 hours marooned at Mar-a-Lago with Donald Trump. And yes, I wrote a profile, a 6,000-word story about that time with him that, suffice it to say, he did not like. But the piece, kind of the gist of the piece, because my whole takeaway from him at that time was that he was almost like a tragic figure, you know? He wanted so desperately for me to take him seriously as a political figure, which I didn't.
Yeah.
You, I know you can't relate to that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to get to our similarities, but... You, for the article, which was for BuzzFeed, you mocked up, like, a joke. This was the joke picture of him in the Oval Office, and that's, like, what it looks like now. So I do want to get back to the parallels we have, which is that was sort of a piece like you did not take him seriously. In 2011, at the Correspondents' Dinner, I said, you know, it's a joke. You're running as a joke. How motivated is he by dopes like us?
Well, this is the thing. We've never met before, but I've always felt this kinship with you because we're like part of this fraternity of haters and losers who questioned Donald Trump's seriousness as a candidate. The thing that I've learned about Donald Trump is that even though he was born with all the wealth and privilege he possibly could have had, even though he's now president, he's always felt like he kind of has his face pressed up against the glass. Like, he feels like he's an outsider and that nobody takes him seriously enough. No one respects him. The insiders are all sneering at him. I was actually told once during the election, this was after or right around the time he was winning the primaries, that that article that I wrote was one of the reasons that he decided to run. But that advisor told me that, this is a former Trump advisor, told me that you were higher on the list.
Okay,
list of reasons.
But he never let it be said he is not a vengeful man. That right, is it the night of the convention he emailed
just
you?
Just a couple days before the convention, before he formally accepted the Republican nomination, I got an email from him saying, you know, McKay, you got it all wrong. And just watch what's going to happen in the general election. Like, you got this all wrong. I can't believe it. That was what was going through his mind, you know, as he's winning the Republican primary. I think that people don't understand just how much this matters to him, just how much it matters to him to prove the haters wrong, to prove everyone wrong. Even now, when he's in the Oval Office, one of the things that reporters are dealing with when they cover this White House is that you'll write a story that's well-sourced, that's accurate about some staffer who's going to be fired. And because Trump will see it reported, he'll change his mind just to be able to say, look, that was fake news. I got them wrong.
Right.
He's really motivated by trying to disprove the press, disprove anybody who he thinks is unfairly treating him.
I want to talk about sourcing real quick because, you know, it seems like we hear so much coming out of this White House, more than maybe we've ever had, we've ever heard. Is it because from the very top, he is a source, that he is talking to the press so often that the people underneath him feel the freedom to do the same?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny, like, Trump does this thing where after his day's work is done, he'll retire to the residence of the White House and just kind of make freewheeling phone calls to, like, random people. And sometimes they're, like, fellow billionaire pals, and sometimes they're media people, and sometimes they're reporters. And it's funny, I've had experiences with this, even when I was interviewing him at Mar-a-Lago, where he'll be talking and he'll tell you a story and he'll be like, okay, this part's off the record. Well, now this part, just attribute it to someone else or whatever. And he'll just put random stuff out there. And that a lot of the stories you see in the press are, it'll say, like, somebody familiar with the situation or, like, a senior White House official, and it'll be the president of the United States.
Yeah. A lurking, slow-moving mass of a man. Yeah. do you think, like, but that actually seems like he's thinking about it more than we maybe give him credit for. So while he's telling a story, he is at least aware enough to know which parts to pull off the record and on the record.
Yeah, in my experience, at least, it was the parts that he wanted me to write that were flattering about him, but he didn't want to have it attributed to him.
Got it.
So it'll be like some heroic story about him or a story about some celebrity who said he was the greatest ever of something, you know. But you put that off the record. Just don't use my name on that part.
So he wants it out there, but he wants it to seem like it came from another source.
Right.
I want to talk about Sam Nunberg real quick. He, an ex-Trump aide who had sort of, you know, what kind of dominated cable news for a 24-hour period when he melted down, maybe is a little unkind, but he was off the rails as far as somebody talking about his time in front of the Mueller investigation. Nunberg was the one who brought you to Mar-a-Lago. He was the one who thought it was a good idea for you to travel with Trump then. Yeah. And so then you wrote this unflattering piece, and Trump was not happy with Nunberg.
Yeah, Trump fired him because of the piece, then rehired him later and then fired him again. The thing about Sam Nunberg that I realized when I was kind of stuck at Mar-a-Lago with him was that he is part of this kind of rotating cast of, like, kind of weird characters that Trump has always liked to have around him, who are all sort of aspiring mini Trumps, you know? Like, they dress like him. They kind of take on his affect and his, like, his linguistic stylings. Like, they'll use the same words as him. And they all try to mimic his kind of performance. And it's funny because, like, you know, he fires people and hires people all the time. But even now in the White House, he keeps people like that around. And he sets up this kind of... The environment he fosters is sort of like the Hunger Games, where he pits his aides against each other and kind of feels like whoever's able to survive and emerge victorious, or that's the best person to have around him.
And so the reports, obviously, of chaos, what seems like what you're saying is he likes chaos, but he does not care for the reports of chaos.
Right. He likes chaos. He just doesn't like the media calling it chaos.
Right.
I think he actually does thrive in this kind of this chaotic environment. He fosters it. He did at the Trump Organization before he was president. He does now as in the White House. But what he doesn't like is when the media is constantly saying, you know, another chaotic day in the White House, you know, and your nightly monologues about he probably doesn't care for those either. But the thing is, he does. It's funny. I think he likes the stories about, you know, people on the brink of being fired. Because if you think about it, he's always had, ever since his apprentice days, he doesn't actually like the act of firing people. You know, we've seen reporting about this. He doesn't like sitting down with a staffer and saying, I'm sorry, this isn't working out. Yeah. But he likes performing his authority and his power, right? He likes, even on The Apprentice, he would practice the delivery of his line and, like, the swivel of his finger when he, like, pointed to the person being fired. And he still does that. Like, he likes the performance of, like, look how powerful I am. Everyone's fate is in my hand, and I get to decide which subordinates will survive and which ones won't. All of that stuff he loves. He just doesn't like when we call it chaos.
So, and has this been, you know, people ask me all the time for my job, has it been just a fascinating time to work in Washington, D.C.? Are you going to look back on it and say, oh, I'm so happy I worked there? Or are you going to look back and say, I wish I had any other job in the world?
I mean, I'm glad that I have, you know, this, like, front row seat to this historic thing. It's just hard because I don't know how it's going to turn out, and nobody does. And obviously, those of us who got his presidential aspirations so wrong are very careful with predictions. But maybe we'll look back at this time as, like, a great moment in American history, and maybe we won't.
Yeah. Here's hoping for your and I's sakes, it's great. Yeah, it turns out great. And you and I get statues.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much for being here. McKay Collins, everybody.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with McKay Collins of The Atlantic. You were just talking about your long history with Donald Trump. Before you even wrote that kind of infamous BuzzFeed piece in 2014, you were reporting on the 2012 campaign with Romney. What was that experience like, and how did that kind of prepare you for the craziness of 2016?
It's weird because people ask me that sometimes, and the campaigns were so radically different that it almost is like I had a different job in 2012 versus 2016. I mean, the main thing that I kind of witnessed in 2012, because Mitt Romney was a boring candidate.
Sure.
I mean, he was like a standard Republican out of the presidential candidate factory, you know, kind of guy. I thought he was basically a decent guy, but just not, he didn't have great political instincts, whatever. But what I did see, you know, was this, he would get up there and kind of give his same stump speech that he did all the time. And then the people who showed up were like begging for more red meat, you know, like they wanted him to be like throwing red meat out about immigration and evil Muslims and jihadists. And so, like, when he lost, and you saw the Republican Party sort of fracture, it created this power vacuum. And the stuff I've been writing about for the last 6 years is all about how, you know, basically Donald Trump realized that this institution, the Republican Party, was like ripe for a takeover. And he did it by giving the people exactly what they wanted.
So Donald Trump realized that as a reporter in the 2016 campaign. Were you kind of realizing, once you said he wasn't going to run, once he was, were you kind of realizing, oh, he's really tapped into something here?
Yeah, especially because I had spent the past like 2 years writing this book about the Republican Party, and I'd interviewed 300 plus people. And it was really clear, you know, I wasn't one of these people who, like, once he ran, like, he's going to win, you know, like, I can't claim that kind of prescience.
I've been wrong every step of the way. I'm fully owning
my wrongness as a pundit and predictor. But as a reporter, I definitely saw on the ground, like, wow, he is like figured this out. Like, yeah, I would go to these Trump rallies and I was like, the people, first of all, there are thousands more people than ever showed up for Romney rallies. And these people are tapped in a way that, and excited about this guy in a way they never were for Mitt Romney or any other Republican candidate I saw.
Well, you mentioned the kind of split between reporter and pundit, and those lines are very blurred. Many reporters show up on cable news. You show up on cable news a lot, but we talk about how the pundits got it wrong. The reporters were reporting these large crowds, but the pundits went on cable news and got it wrong. How do you think about the world of punditry post 2016?
Yeah, it's funny. It does kind of feel like most of the pundit class has not learned any lessons from 2016. And the biggest lesson I've learned is just to not bother with predictions. I'm not good at it anyway, but also it's not really, I don't think it adds that much value. Like, I've been thinking a lot about this. I don't think that going on TV and, you know, confidently predicting what's going to happen actually gives the audience anything they need to know. What I try to do is have my reporting inform my analysis of the state of play and, you know, what factors would inform the situation to make it go one way or the other. But, you know, in terms of predictions, not even just election outcomes, but this person is going to do this. This person is probably going to do this. Robert Mueller is going to get fired. Like, there's not a lot of reason to do that.
Right. And also, your predictions will be wrong.
Exactly.
Everyone's, well, how can you predict this administration? Well, it's crazy.
Especially in this environment.
Right.
I mean, I do hope that, and I should be kinder. Like, I do see some of my colleagues kind of stepping back from the prediction game in this climate, because I think that in a fundamental way, like in almost an elemental way, Donald Trump has kind of torn apart a lot of our assumptions about how national politics works.
Absolutely.
And how Washington works. And so anyone who's claiming to like, know, like, oh, look, I've been around a long time, this is what's going to happen, I don't think we can trust anyone who says that they know what's going to happen.
Oh, totally. I mean, just the basic premise of electability.
Right.
I think Trump was the least electable, Hillary was the most electable.
Well, and all the rules about who could be a presidential candidate. You had to be in the Senate or a governor, and you need to, like, even if you were in the House of Representatives, that was a little too far. This guy has no political or governing experience at all. I think that going into 2020, you could see people from all corners of society running for president, and there's no reason for us to discount them based just on resume alone.
Totally. I do want to ask a little bit more about campaign reporting. Mm-hmm. So we all watch campaigns, they go on forever. Is it exciting to be on the campaign trail, or is it boring because you are seeing more or less the same? I guess it's different with Trump, but traditionally you are seeing the same speech over and over and over. Or is it something exciting and invigorating?
Well, so when I covered the Mitt Romney campaign, I, after like a few weeks on the trail, could recite his stump speech word for word.
Totally.
I knew what he was going to say every day.
Do you remember any of the lines?
Oh, man.
Sorry to put you on the spot like that.
I just remember he told a lot of stories about job creators. Like, there was one about the like this furniture store in Las Vegas. He had like a lot of stories. Man, I'm having like PTSD. But the thing is, that was one of the things that made Trump so compelling.
Totally.
on the campaign trail, is none of his speeches were the same. He would get up, you had no idea what he was going to do. He'd just start riffing in like a really unpredictable, mesmerizing way. And whether you loved him or hated him, you were just like, what is this guy doing? And like,
totally.
People just wanted to watch him. And I think that if there's like a positive lesson that maybe people could take out of this, it would be, you know, like maybe candidates can like unbutton a little bit and try.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about style, like just be a little more upfront about what you want to do. Say what you will about Donald Trump, he told us what he wanted to do in office,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
The immigration stuff, like the Muslim ban. I mean, he did not hide who he was on the campaign trail.
Totally. Well, you've written at The Atlantic about how, you know, he ran this anti-establishment
campaign.
So
this is the exception, what you're getting at.
Oh, sure. Yes, I guess it's this. On certain issues, yeah, there is the exception here that he ran this anti-establishment campaign, this anti kind of like elite campaign. And then when he got to D.C. on many issues, not all, like immigration, of course, is an exception, but on many issues, he courted the donor class, courted
right.
the elites, and they courted him. Can you talk about how that relationship evolved?
Yeah, that's important. So it's funny. I remember a few weeks after Trump won, I think it was in January of 2017, I was at this dinner party and there were a lot of like corporate elites and political elites and people were like panicked about, you know, this guy who was about to come into the Oval Office. And I was kind of sharing my like insights into Trump. And this guy came up to me who worked for a Fortune 500 company and was like, you know, you need to go into consulting because all these Fortune 500 companies are trying to figure out how to get what they want out of Trump. And like, you could make a ton of money just telling them what you know about his psyche. I decided not to do that, maybe to my my financial detriment, but they figured it out pretty quickly because the reality is, he, as much as he ran as this anti-establishment figure, he was desperate to be accepted and loved by the establishment. Like, all he wants is, you know, he grew up in Queens, like wanting to be part of the kind of Manhattan elite class. Even when he was running for president, all he wanted was the political elite to take him seriously. As much as he rails against them, he wants them to love him. And so as soon as, like, you know, corporations and the entrenched Republican establishment, as soon as they figured that out, they knew how to work him. And you know, look at the tax bill, look at a lot of the people he's appointed. Like, they've had a lot of wins in the Trump presidency.
Absolutely. And we were chatting earlier and you said this is kind of driven by status anxiety.
Yeah.
Which is it puts such a fine point on who he is and how he operates since his developer days, the TV days, to the presidency.
Yeah.
And you've seen it all along the way.
It's weird because it doesn't make sense that he would have status anxiety. He was born into a rich family. He's been rich his whole life.
He's the president.
He's the president of the United States. But like, he's still, even as president, I mean, the reason he retires to the residence at the end of the day and, you know, makes these angry phone calls to his like billionaire friends and stuff is because he feels like every day he's under siege by the true elites, the true insiders that still,
oh my gosh,
you know, he it's almost like he doesn't totally realize how much power he has, you know, like he still feels like he's an outsider. And that's been, it's fundamental to his psyche. I didn't realize it the first time I hung out with him, but as I watched him on the campaign trail, it became clear that that was just fundamental to who he was.
Yeah. Well, your reporting has really crystallized who he is. As Seth said, it is a crazy wild time to be covering politics, but we are so glad you were doing it. Thank you so much for being here and congrats on all the work. Good luck with what you're working on next, which I imagine is
yes, thank you.
Confusing and wild. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
It was such a pleasure. Thanks, McKay.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.